The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Good morning, comrades. Thanks everybody for getting up for this early morning Sunday session. I think the Socialism Planning Committee probably figured there'd be a lot of parents here who would have no choice to be awake at this hour. Raise your hand if you've been up for a few hours. So the premise of this talk is that while reproductive justice often looks at the right to reproduce or not reproduce, we should also look at how pregnancy and childbirth can best be supported. In my section of the talk, I'm going to cover a number of challenges that come up during pregnancy and childbirth. And unfortunately, I had to cut my first draft of the talk by literally 75%. So if you come away thinking that I skipped over some important topics or didn't do a topic justice, that is true. So I'll just start by addressing some stereotypes about pregnant people. So first of all, not all pregnant people are women. We know trans men and other people assigned female at birth, but don't identify as women can be pregnant. And I think it's just important to acknowledge this from the start, because in order for trans men and gender nonconforming people to access care, they need to be made to feel welcome and understood. So I'm going to use a lot of gender neutral language in this talk. It's sometimes a little clumsy or awkward or whatever. And then I'll also refer to moms a lot, especially when a text I'm referring to does so, or a study does so. And I think both of those are appropriate. So we can talk about that in the discussion too. The next point, not all pregnant people are in straight married couples, although sometimes they're assumed to be. Some are partnered with women or gender nonconforming people. Some are single. And the whole assumption that pregnant people have a partner, often assumed to be a man who makes more money than they do, who can support them during the periods when they are unable to work, has just never been less true. Next one is not exactly a stereotype, but sometimes we forget that pregnancy starts long before you can see that a person is pregnant. Lots of people are pregnant for a time and you don't know it because they have an abortion or a miscarriage, or they don't even know that they were pregnant. And in fact, you know, there's this culture, particularly in the U.S., of keeping pregnancies a secret for the first trimester. The logic is that most miscarriages happen in those first 14 weeks, so like, why announce that you're having a baby until they're risk of miscarriage is very low. And it's true that about a third of pregnancies are estimated to end in miscarriage, but then we should ask, why wait for near certainty to share the news of a pregnancy? Especially when many pregnant people experience nausea and exhaustion that ranges from mild to quite severe. And keeping a pregnancy secret makes it difficult to get like any kind of accommodation at work or even like sympathy from the people around you. Unfortunately though, a terminated pregnancy, whether by abortion or miscarriage, is like seriously suspect in the US. I think that's why people keep it a secret. So it's widely but wrongly understood that pregnant people have the ability to drastically reduce their chances of miscarriage by avoiding a whole host of activities, from drinking caffeine to vigorous exercise to dyeing their hair. In reality, about 90% of miscarriages in the first trimester are a result of chromosomal problems. So this means that the gestational parent's body realizes that the embryo or fetus is developing in a way that's incompatible with life and expels it. There's nothing that could have been done to prevent it, and while it's very difficult to lose a wanted pregnancy, it's a natural part of reproduction and not evidence of wrongdoing. One source that I found very useful in understanding that remaining 10% of miscarriages, among some other things, is Expecting Better by Emily Oster. She's a University of Chicago economist who found the existing pregnancy books lacking any kind of evidence-based approach. Instead of just laying out a bunch of rules for what you can and cannot do while pregnant, without explaining why or where they got their information. So she decided to review all of the existing literature and write about it. And that's the first and last time you will hear a plug for a University of Chicago economist at the Socialism Conference. There's a lot of uncertainty in the research because most studies are observational, not controlled, because, you know, it wouldn't be ethical to like assign half of the participants to eat a certain food and the other half not and see who has more miscarriages, right? Can't do that. But there's still enough evidence to prove a lot of the fears overblown. So one example is the conventional wisdom in pregnancy books and mom blogs that it's safest to limit to one cup of coffee a day, or better yet, avoid caffeine at all. Oster comes to a very different conclusion, writing, quote, Women who experience nausea early in pregnancy are less likely to miscarry. We know that nausea is a sign of a healthy pregnancy, unfortunately. At the same time, it causes women to avoid caffeine. But this means that women who drink a lot of coffee are probably those not experiencing nausea. These women are more likely to miscarry. Okay, so it's not the caffeine, it's the lack of nausea that's correlated with the miscarriage. Okay, so she concluded that it would be fine to drink like 3 to 4 cups of coffee, maybe even more a day. But this doesn't stop books, blogs, doctors, and baristas from scaring pregnant people into enduring groggy, decaffeinated mornings. Some other examples. Turns out that the condition known as fetal alcohol syndrome is actually highly correlated with smoking, poverty, and malnutrition. So it's actually safe to drink somewhat during pregnancy. Even the boogeyman of the crack baby turns out not to be true. And all those prescription drugs with disclaimers that say women who are pregnant or nursing shouldn't use them, it's often just to protect themselves from lawsuits. They're not necessarily dangerous. One reason for this conservative approach to what pregnant people can and cannot ingest is over-reliance on flawed studies. But I think more than that, many doctors just have no faith in women to make reasonable decisions for themselves or their babies. Another area of public scrutiny of pregnant people is weight gain. So it is a medical fact that the more weight gain during pregnancy is correlated with a larger for gestational age baby. And large babies are more likely to need a C-section or an instrument-assisted delivery, like using forceps or a vacuum extractor. But the concern is skewed toward large for gestational age babies, even though small for gestational age babies have much more serious concerns like difficulty breathing, difficulty regulating blood sugar, atypical neurological signs, higher mortality rates, higher risk of diabetes, the list goes on. So since it's actually safer to have a larger baby, perhaps the recommendations against gaining too much weight are actually just conventional fat shaming. The last example of public scrutiny of pregnant people I'll touch on here is just gendering of the fetus. What are you having, they ask? And that's supposed to mean gender. Since gender is a social construct and fetuses exist alone in the womb and don't socialize with anyone, they don't have gender. So all someone is really asking about is the genitalia of the fetus. Who cares? Okay, let's move on to actually giving birth. One way of characterizing a typical hospital birth is that there's a cascade of interventions on offer, meaning once you start medicalizing aspects of childbirth, this can get in the way of the body's natural way of progressing through labor and can actually cause you to need more interventions. These interventions are important, right? It's really important that they exist. Though they've actually come to from doctors experimenting on black women without anesthesia, and we've got to recognize that there's like a really gross history of where some of the interventions come from. But you know, in general, it's good that there are some of these interventions because they can be life-saving. But when providers recommend them unnecessarily, they can actually cause labor to be more difficult and complicated. So here's one typical sort of birth scenario. You get to the hospital and you get hooked up to a fetal heart monitor and an IV in case you might need something by IV later. So now you can't move around and use any traditional techniques of switching positions to manage labor pains. And after a few hours, when the anesthesiologist comes in and asks if you're ready for an epidural, which is like a needle inserted into the epidural space in your spine to administer pain medication and like numb the lower half of your body, you sure are ready for that. By the way, you haven't been allowed to eat or drink anything other than ice chips because of this rare chance that you might have an emergency C-section with general anesthesia and be one of the 2 in 10 million laboring parents who asphyxiate during labor. So you're hungry and exhausted. The epidural slows down your labor, so you're given Pitocin, a synthetic form of oxytocin, which is the hormone that stimulates contractions. The Pitocin causes much stronger contractions than those naturally occurring, so when your epidural wears off, you're barely able to cope with the contractions. Either that, or the epidural is really heavy, and when it's time to push, you can't feel the contractions, and everyone in the room has to, like, shout, push, push, like, in sync with this monitor that you're still hooked up to, that's, like, measuring the contractions. Okay, so maybe due to, like, exhaustion, or maybe because you can't feel the contractions very well, your pushing is not necessarily very effective, and after a few hours of trying to push the baby out, the doctor takes out a vacuum extractor to attach to the baby's head to help push. So this carries a higher risk of tearing, but it might be your last chance to avoid a C-section. So you can see how some seemingly minor preventative rules, like being hooked up to the IV, continuous fetal monitoring, no food or drink, have caused this cascade that could lead to more interventions. Providers end up recommending interventions that make their job easier but aren't necessarily in the best interest of the patient, and they often do this without the gestational parent's consent. One 2002 study found that 25% of moms had episiotomy, so that's a preemptive cutting of the perineum, the area between the vagina and the anus, which was once thought to prevent like a messier tear, but actually doesn't do that. And so 25% of moms had episiotomies. 73% of them were not asked if they wanted them. This is just one example of a trend known as obstetric violence. Take the story of Caroline Malatesta, an Alabama mom who wanted an unmedicated natural birth and was promised by her obstetrician that she could have wireless monitoring so that she could like move around freely during her labor, but was forced to labor on her back despite her baby showing no signs of distress. According to an article in Vice, quote, she describes how her nurse forcibly wrestled her onto her back while another nurse pressed the infant's crowning head into her vagina for 6 minutes. Malatesta says her screams of stop were ignored and she struggled in what she called torture. Her son Jack was born healthy and unharmed, but Malatesta suffered severe nerve damage as a result of the assault. She was later diagnosed with PTSD and pudendal neuralgia, an extremely painful and incurable condition which prevents her from having sex and ever giving birth again. She won a lawsuit on the basis of misleading advertising about what kind of birth experience was on offer at the hospital, but unfortunately it's not actually clear that what the nurse did was illegal. Fully 90% of doulas, these are like birth support women who can come with you to your labor and sort of help you navigate this whole process and give you support. So fully 90% of doulas and delivery nurses say that they've witnessed providers giving little or no time for the laboring parent to make a decision about a proposed procedure. And 60% have seen providers perform procedures that the patient explicitly objected to. These violations come not just from older male doctors, but from younger doctors, female doctors, nurses, and midwives. And unsurprisingly, the doulas interviewed found that obstetric violence was even worse for women of color. The challenges don't end with the delivery process. Sorry, deep breath, we'll move on to beyond the delivery process. Breastfeeding is challenging both because we no longer live in multi-generational family situations where we learn from and support each other with nursing, and because it's really hard to keep up breastfeeding while working because pumping is just really logistically difficult. Other postpartum issues include pain and infection, hypertension and stroke, heart problems, blood clots, anxiety, and depression. Clearly, new parents need a great deal of care during this time, but while baby's first appointment is usually a few days after birth, postpartum parents often have to wait 4 to 6 weeks to be seen and may only have one postpartum appointment. It's not hard to trace this attitude back to a supposedly pro-life culture that doesn't actually care about women's lives. Another issue for pregnant people is health insurance, because let's face it, giving birth is expensive. On average, $13,524 for a vaginal birth without complications, or over $19,000 for a C-section. Luckily for people with insurance, the cost of giving birth won't be quite so high, but of course, lots of pregnant people, including, or especially people of color, don't have insurance. A particularly strange insurance issue is the practice of infant billing. As one mom tweeted, quote, just got the insurance bill for giving birth. Over $22,000 charged to me, then $6,014.83 billed separately to the newborn. Apparently, this wasn't a fluke. And newborns are often charged separately from their gestational parents for absurd services such as newborn nursery, when the baby actually never left mom's room, or choosing an out-of-network provider while mom was napping. Another example of lacking a social safety net is parental leave. Few states guarantee paid parental leave in the US, and where they do, it's usually limited to full-time workers at large companies. As a result, a full quarter of mothers are back at work within 10 days of having a baby, with an additional 22% by 40 days. This doesn't allow healing from childbirth, whether that's a C-section, a perineal tear, diastasis recti, which is a separation of the abdominal muscles that affects 60% of new birth parents, pelvic floor issues, etc. And even a vaginal birth without any complications is just a major event requiring recovery. Not to mention that newborn babies wake up throughout the night, making it impossible to get enough rest to go back to work in the morning, or that it's just nice to have time to bond with your baby. And we can applaud that. In many cultures, there's a 40-day rest period postpartum because of all these reasons that are recognized. What this usually means is that families, and in particular female relatives, will collectively take care of new moms for this period, relieving them of work and other family responsibilities. But what's actually needed is that care for babies and new parents comes from the state, right? Paid, guaranteed, not private in your family. Okay, so I've highlighted some areas where racism exacerbates a number of the challenges of pregnancy for women of color, but we also just need to highlight that Black mothers and babies are at a higher risk for complications and death related to childbirth. And this can be attributed to a combination of systemic racism, segregated neighborhoods, inadequate schools, mass incarceration, police brutality, and the toxic stress that accompanies those issues. What's more is that the U.S. overall has the highest maternal death rate in the global north, because more inequality actually leads to worse health outcomes for all. One last problem I'd like to explore, the environment. Because it turns out environmental pollution has a huge impact on both pregnancy and then especially breastfeeding, because of biomagnification, which you might have learned about in science class. So you think about if plants are contaminated, then the small animals that eat the plants have like a higher level of concentration, and so on up to humans at the top of the food chain who end up with the highest level of pollutants in our system. But actually, it's not adult humans that reside at the top of that food chain, it's breastfed babies. So they actually have the highest concentration because they're eating from adult humans. So given all of the scrutiny of what pregnant people ingest and the potential harm that it could do to fetuses, where is the outrage for polluting the environment to the point of endangering pregnant people and contaminating breast milk? So that was a bunch of things that can go wrong with how we handle pregnancy and childbirth in American capitalism, but which are, I think, all consequences of a healthcare system that doesn't trust women and childbearing people. Now Corey's going to go on to explain why American capitalism developed such a sexist healthcare system.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. So we're actually in the tradition of birth work going to actually start the next session with a birth story. So I'm really pleased that my friend and comrade Rosanna is going to be sharing the story of how she welcomed her son Marcel.
Good morning, everybody. For many years before I got pregnant, I started learning about the state of childbirth in the United States. And coming from Puerto Rico, I knew that I wanted to go home to give birth. And I knew that I wanted to have a home birth. Both of my grandmothers gave birth at home, 12 kids each. My mother didn't give birth at home, but she gave birth vaginally to the three of us, and I was convinced that I was going to have a vaginal birth. I knew the likelihood of a C-section, which is 49% in Puerto Rico, but all my family's there, and I wanted my child to have a piece of paper that said that he was born in Puerto Rico. I wanted him to know that that was his birthplace. So I got ready, I got a midwife in Puerto Rico. I saw a midwife here in Chicago until week 36, which is when I left to the island. And I had everything completely ready to welcome my child at my mother's house in Puerto Rico at week 36. I got to week 37, 38, 39. I was seeing my midwife periodically. At week 40, my midwife said, okay, you've been at 1 centimeter for a while. It's now 40 weeks and we have to transfer care to my backup doctor. So we transferred care, but I continued to see her under close supervision of the two doctors. So I went after the 40th week, several times a week to check on the baby, and the baby was fine, and the doctors were really accommodating. I would still see my midwife. She would come visit me, and they were okay with me waiting. I was clear that I wanted to wait as long as I could to see if I could go into labor. I was getting really strong contractions periodically, and sometimes I thought I was going into labor, but it never actually progressed. At week 41, they gave me a monitor, a small Doppler that I would use at my house, and I checked my baby's heart rate every day in the morning and in the evening. We tried to induce naturally too. We used nipple stimulation. We extracted milk with a milk machine. I tried castor oil. I ate spicy food. I had sex. I used primrose oil in capsules in my cervix. I did everything that you could naturally do to try to kick off labor, but none of it worked. Then in the middle of week 42, I fell. I was so big at that point, I'm a pretty small human being, and I was not able to manage all the weight of my body, and I tripped and fell on my hip. And after that point, I had to go to the hospital for an ultrasound. The baby was fine, but the doctor started getting really concerned, so the doctors told me, at this point, you should think about being induced. I asked them for a day to think about it, and then I ended up in the hospital the next day, induced. When I got to the hospital, I was still at 1 centimeter. I was giving Cervidil, and after that, I was giving Pitocin. But after Pitocin, my water broke pretty quick, and I was in labor for 24 hours, and I was in labor without any medication for pain because I wanted to have an unmedicated vaginal birth. So the next morning, the doctor came to check on me, and I was at 1 centimeter. Yeah, that sucked. and it was a devastating moment. I just went to war with my body. And the interesting thing is that I thought I was helping my body, but I was actually fighting it. And then the doctor said, I think it's time to get the baby out. My water had been broken probably for 22 hours. And they were being really accommodating because they really knew that I wanted to have a vaginal birth, and they trusted me. But at that point, they were really anxious, and we decided to go on with the C-section. When I heard that I needed to go and have a C-section, I realized I didn't know anything about a C-section. The only thing I knew about a C-section was the negative aspects of it. I knew that it was major surgery. I had learned so much about the risks implied in a C-section, and I took that very seriously. And I saw birth as a very normal thing. It was a normal thing in my family for generations, not a pathology. It's something that didn't need to be medicated, something that needed to be experienced. And I wanted to be able to have that experience and to give my child the healthiest start that I could. I had internalized that this is what women's bodies do naturally, that my body had been designed to give birth. So I went into that operating room so scared. And I was really lucky that the birthing team that was there, the anesthesiologist, the nurses, the doctor, were all incredibly humane. And they made sure that I felt safe, that I didn't feel judged for waiting so long. At the beginning, I was prepped alone, but after I was ready to have the C-section, both my husband and my midwife were able to come in. And my midwife was a great support for us, and she was there. She sang the praises of the doctor, and she said she had been through C-sections with him before, which was very comforting. Marcel was born, and I was so tense that I got a spasm on my right shoulder, and I couldn't move my arm because it hurt so bad. So when Marcel was born, the doctor said if I wanted to breastfeed the baby, that I could, but I actually couldn't because my body was a wreck at that point. So I just had him on my chest for a little bit to have skin-on-skin contact, and then the hospital takes over, and they had very specific policies. So Marcel got everything that I didn't want for him in this call-as-fuck room. And I was really high at that point on pain medications, and I just decided that I was never walking again. So I started asking everyone why I couldn't move my legs, and everybody kept telling me it's because you have anesthesia, you're gonna be okay. But I have made a decision that I was never walking. I even asked the escort person that takes the bed. I can't feel my legs. It's like you're gonna be okay. Probably an hour and a half later, they brought the baby to my room, and I started my journey as a mother. But I had a lot of support in the hospital, a lot of support for breastfeeding, which is really an amazing thing because in Puerto Rico, that is not a reality for a lot of people. And I was not in a fancy hospital. It's a hospital and a group of doctors that work mostly with people that are on Medicaid. I had a C-section that was incredibly humane. I felt like I mattered. Like my wisdom, my decisions were validated. I was really lucky that I was able to be treated by doctors that were very aware of the issues with birth in the island, and that they had a midwife on their team, and they trust her with me the whole time. I thought that I would be at a much more danger if I had a C-section, but at that point that was not true. At that point the danger was Marcel was not coming out, and a C-section needs to be available for moments like this. I think that woman should be heard, and every woman should get whatever she needs when she's laboring or when she wants to give birth. I'm really grateful that that was my experience and that I was heard and that I felt validated. I think that we should definitely go with the best science and evidence-based methods, and women should be completely informed of what are the best science and what will give us the best result. And at the end of the day, we need to respect women's choice about their own bodies because they know better.
Everybody just like take a deep breath.
If you need tissues.
Mom brought tissues. I had some thoughts prepared about why birth stories are so important. And then this weekend happened, and I was like, duh, like this is not like rocket science, people. The personal is so profoundly political, the political is so profoundly personal. And I think I am in the business of birth stories, and hoping to, you know, make them good for people. And there is no greater privilege in life than being a midwife. And I so frequently hear stories that are shit, you know, from many people in this room. In fact, who I love dearly. At every step of the pregnancy journey, I'm looking out and I know you, I see you. And I am that too. And I have spent so many years of my life really thinking about these issues are so profoundly personal to all of us, and how important it is going to be to really develop a politics of birth justice within the socialist movement. It is part and parcel of our work around reproductive justice that this organization has been dedicated to, which is why I became a Marxist in the first place. In every session that you've been at this weekend, brave and beautiful comrades have stood up and talked about the hope that we see when we look around at the badasses in our midst. And I know that the birth story is going to take on the kind of significance that Me Too takes on, the kind of significance that Black Lives Matter takes on, the kind of significance that, you know, stories of illegal abortion and forced sterilization took on among a previous generation of fighters for reproductive justice. And we have to have the politics that can explain how the fuck we got here, because this is not natural. The story that Stephanie told about a medicalized birth experience, and just that sort of one tip of the iceberg of the way that intervention seeps into everybody's experience, even if you have the most incredible healthcare providers or insurance or setting. Our lives are so profoundly gendered and racialized in ways that I can't think of how it is more personal than when it comes to our own autonomy over our reproductive lives. I think this is hopefully the beginning of that kind of conversation in our organization. I think it's tremendously important, and it's no different than the work that we're doing in the other movements that I already mentioned, and that we'll continue to expand upon in areas like sex work, bisexuality, another topic that I think about quite frequently. So I guess that is to say, I don't think it's going to be that surprising to anybody here that it's not an accident that our society doesn't trust women. Everybody feels that. That's not new. And it's not an accident. It is absolutely part and parcel of the way that the so-called maternity care system was developed in this country. And it was a multi-pronged, very messy, ridiculous process. A lot of it actually took place here in the city of Chicago. So I actually want to say one quick thing about Rosanna's story, which is that I think the thing that makes her story actually a positive story in the midst of everything else, which is not easy given the situation in Puerto Rico right now, is that Rosanna actually worked with a midwife who she trusted and who she had a relationship with. And those midwives were in a situation where they had an excellent relationship with their physician colleagues. And Rosanna was at the center of that story in every way. And it's not about the fact that she had a C-section, although it is, because that is the moment that we're in. But it's really about kind of what it actually could look like if we actually had access to not only, you know, providers that we could develop that relationship with, but like a world where that's just a given, like that's your basic fundamental right. And I think it can be hard to wrap your head around this stuff. Rosanna and I talked about the sort of cult attitude that those of us live in who are parents. And especially those of us that are like so disgusted by the medicalization of childbirth. And there's actually sort of a narrative within the natural birth community that, you know, the problem is just that women just maybe we get what we asked for, you know, that we don't choose midwives enough. You know, that we haven't done enough of the research ourselves. And that's why we're in these situations. And I feel that sometimes, honestly, when people tell me their stories, and I can think of 10 things that went wrong that, from my perspective, with the wisdom that I have, would have gone differently with a different relationship with a provider, with a different birth setting that actually put the gestational parent at the center of it.
And so that's real. We live in this world that's really contradictory, where you just can't get, in general, mass access to this type of care. And so I think the cult of like home birth is actually kind of problematic in a lot of ways, right? It can be very judgmental, and also really, I think people don't have a sort of a dialectical understanding of why we got here, and it leads you to all kinds of wacky conclusions and a lot of skepticism of the medical world, because look at what it's done to people. How could there be anything good from science? Look at what's been done in the name of science. I know there were other talks about that this weekend. But I want to say that the biggest weakness of this approach is that it utilizes a choice rather than a social rights-based framework. Centering the woman as consumer, as the target for change, rather than the systemic factors that contribute to the degradation of pregnant women and their health. Just as the most effective demands of the women's liberation movement included free abortion on demand before the movement adopted the Meeker defend choice. The most effective demands for birth justice movement must start from the premise of opposition to the social forces that shape the context in which birthing choices, so-called, and experiences occur. Yes, we have agency, but we are not operating under circumstances of our own choosing. And I think to arrive at an alternative or a revolutionary approach to birth justice that moves away from a service model and an NGOification of, solutions, which may play a role, but I think we need more than that. And I mean no disrespect to folks who are doing that work, because it's absolutely essential, but we have to go beyond that. We have to start with some questions. As Marxists, in what ways does a for-profit medical model promote the overuse of medical interventions in otherwise uncomplicated pregnancies and labor of placental mammals? How did obstetricians, whose profession primarily trains them to see and respond, particularly surgically, to the pathological aspects of pregnancy and birth, become the care providers and the very respected and very well compensated care providers that they are, and many of them are very, very, very talented. It's not about that. Why are they the providers for 90% of American women in pregnancy? Why didn't the development of capitalism in the United States of America permit or encourage the expansion, professionalization, and improvements scientifically of midwifery and family-centered care? Is there something fundamental about our society that doesn't respect women? Yes. So I am running out of time. So yes, midwifery was overturned in the United States. To tremendous cost to pregnant people. In particular, I don't have to tell anybody that this affects most sharply Black women, women of color, immigrants, queer folks, anybody that is marginalized in this society. And that has everything to do with the fact of this like bizarre sequence of events that occurred that has nothing, a lot of it was centered here in the city of Chicago. It's a fascinating history that I would love to maybe come back on later. But I just want to say a little bit about what midwifery is, because I think there's, Stephanie went through some of the myths about pregnancy and pregnant people, and I think I just want to say a couple of things about what midwifery is, both historically and right now. But I have to say that really, really briefly, because time is just slipping. There's a song about that. Okay.
So midwives, obviously this is way more than I can say, but the midwifery philosophy of care is to trust women and to partner with women and pregnant people. Historically, it has also included, you know, just being present with people through major reproductive life cycles and viewing women's bodies and the bodies of childbearing people not as pathological, but as, you know, something that is actually really powerful and capable of a whole wide variety of things along a spectrum. And I think, you know, the fact that it was so central in the city of Chicago to eliminate midwifery alongside criminalizing abortion says everything about, and that it was a really viciously racist, sexist, and xenophobic campaign, because who were the midwives? Black women and immigrant women and women. Ooh, those ignorant, dirty, rat pie midwives who had great outcomes, actually, and were doing really badass things, and we would never know, you know, how much farther that could have gone if maybe midwives had been better organized or the fucking capitalist class hadn't, you know, decided that it was so important to control childbearing and criminalize abortion and take, you know, really women's power over reproduction away from the people who are making, living a life of pregnancy, childbearing, parenting, social reproduction. So I'm actually gonna have to stop at that real quick, and we're gonna have a brief, we're gonna go over time a little bit. I'm sorry, we can't help ourselves. The royal we, sorry.
The comradely we.
we'll take a break from the frontal presentation, and now we've kind of talked about some of the issues that come up in pregnancy and childbirth, and we wanted to just invite you guys to think about what would a better system look like. What would if we're talking about a birth justice movement, what are some of the things that we could like think about as demands in the here and now, right? Reforms that would make things better for pregnant people and make childbirth more positive, but also like vision for the future, like in a socialist world, how could we design a totally better system? So I just want to invite people to just popcorn out, like, what would you want to see, whether it's like something that seems like small and doable now or something big in a vision for the future. So don't be shy. Mm-hmm. Keep it coming.
Bring that mortality. Mm-hmm. Consent practices with doctors and nurses.
Access to whatever birthing methods you want, no matter what your income is.
Mm-hmm. Access to midwives.
Abolishing the idea of the nuclear family, so we actually have extended families, churches, and relatives.
Universal guaranteed income. actual scientific evidence-based information.
Paid parentally for a really long time.
Years.
Not charging $15,000 for that.
Right?
A universal healthcare system. Baby box.
The consequences from of such a violence.
Mm-hmm, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
And the right of disabled parents to keep their children, right? That's and right. Not live in fear of them being taken away.
Yes. If they choose to adapt, they're to be respected as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Stop recommending and focus more on mental health care.
That's right.
Yeah. Universal family leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Sex education.
Yeah.
Free daycare.
So we kind of started out with like a list of our own, and then we thought, actually you guys came up with a lot of stuff that we didn't think of and most of the stuff that we did think of, and I think it's really, you know, helpful to sort of start with that vision, because we did, you know, paint a little bit of a dismal picture, and we certainly don't want to scare people off if they're thinking of having children, or we want to get to like a vision of something positive. We can also talk about, I think, some of the more positive experience that that people do have in the hearing now, because there are, at least for a small slice of people, like access to midwives. And we can talk about, I think it's important to say, greater access to midwifery care. I'm going to kick it back over to Corey for just a couple more minutes, and then we're going to open it up to a broader discussion.
Yeah, y'all are smart, you know. Like, we need to, there's nothing else I really need to add to that. That's a part, you guys hit all the things that I wanted to say. I think there's two parts, right? And I loved how this came up, because it's not just about narrowly what happens in the laboring room or to the parent who just had a baby having like leave. It is about reproductive justice and what it means to live in a world and be able to be pregnant and parent and have and experience one of the most transformative moments of your life, whatever that looks like, whatever you want that to look like, whatever shapes what you want that to look like, that's your experience and you need to have the right to that. It's part of your body and it shouldn't be, you know, taken away from you. I think we have to do both those things. We have to both bring, you know, the politics of birth justice into, you know, the movement for Black Lives, for instance, as people are doing. That's nothing new. But I think we need to really see how all of these things feed into each other. The trans moment is taking up all of these questions. These are not, you know, isolated things. This is all a very intersectional world that is happening. Like, in what ways, like bringing in the demands around healthcare, around, you know, care and access for folks with disabilities, like how does that really strengthen what we're saying, that these things make feminism bigger and stronger and more powerful? But then we also have to say, like, as we're doing that, how are we talking about a type of world where birth can be truly like a liberated experience and part of a liberated like social reproduction? Because we're so smart and we can do so much better than this garbage society that we live in. I think, you know, whatever, I'm gonna guess I end on a classic ISO note because I've been so inspired this weekend too. But like, you know, I think of, you know, some of the really cool stuff that we have from the women's health movement actually, and the springing up of feminist health centers, and like the, you know, the model of care that like the Jane Collective utilized, for instance. You know, I'm not promoting that we do that, but I think all the things that we inherit about gentle speculum exams, about knowing that you have a cervix, about knowing, you know, that you don't have a cervix, like, you know, whatever that is, we inherit that from a previous tradition of struggle. And I think I draw on that all the time in my clinical practice, but I'm never going to be the best midwife ever in this sea of like misogyny that I live in, and trans misogyny that I live in, and, you know, racism that I live in, because you can't, we have to so fundamentally remake society in order to really put, you know, the pregnant person and the family, yes, abolish the family, by the way. I think that some of the mamas that are going to be leading this revolution are going to be at front and center of that, and I mean that, like, I love my kid. I love, you know, being a mother, but imagine how much cooler it would be if it was really, truly a tribal affair. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.